at Daisy Spark. Hello, TDSers, and welcome back to a brand new episode of That Daisy Spark. I'm Nehal.
And I'm Annika.
Last year, it was the 10th anniversary of the Wisconsin shooting at Oak Creek Sikh Temple. For those who don't know details, a white supremacist opened fire at a temple, killing 6 Sikh worshippers and leaving one paralyzed from the attack, who also died in 2020. It was the deadliest attack on Sikh Americans in our nation's history. And tragically, attacks on our nation's houses of worship have only become more common. And events like this have really pushed us to step back and take a look at our community as a whole and see how we can support and be allies to our communities outside of our own subgroups.
As 2 Hindu straight women, there is a lot of variety or minority experience that we bring to the table, which means that learning is that much more important. Empathy is that much more important for the people in our communities in different subgroups. As we've gone through the years of the podcast, we've learned alongside you. We say it all the time, and I'll share a story about that actually. This episode hits deeply because at the beginning of That Desi Spark, then the Woke Desi, we did an episode where one of us had mentioned that Sikhism was an offshoot of Hinduism. It was an off kind of comment that just, you know, flew off the tip of the tongue as we continued our conversation. And eventually we got called out on Twitter. And it wasn't until a kind friend, Jess Kaur, educated me and put in the labor to explain that Sikhism is often erased in Hindu-dominated society and overwritten as a Hindu offshoot. There have been so many atrocities against Sikhs, their marginalized community within a broader South Asian group. And I'll admit that I genuinely didn't know some of these erasure tactics. I ignorantly regurgitated what I'd always been told. And that's the point here. It's on us to learn more, to serve as stronger allies, to challenge the narratives that we've been told, especially if they come from a majority group, and to do our best to understand that while we say we're a South Asian community, the diaspora is wide and it's deep and it's filled with marginalized groups that are worth supporting.
One person that really stands out when it comes to being an ally and fighting for the community is Simranjeet Singh. After a wave of hate crimes against Sikhs swept the U.S. in the months after 9/11, Simran realized that ignorance is actually a matter of life and death. He turned that drive into a career as a scholar and advocate for religious freedom.
Simran has been recognized by Time magazine as one of 16 people fighting for a more equal America and is the executive director of the Aspen Institute's program on religion and society. He's also the author of the book, The Light We Give, How Sikh Wisdom Can Transform Your Life.
We're so excited to have him on our podcast today to talk about the radicalization of religious identity has affected communities locally and nationally, and why education and establishing an interfaith community could create a more inclusive world.
We're getting heavy. We're getting deep. So get ready, listeners. Welcome to our podcast, Simran. We're so happy to have you tonight.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be with you.
So I would love if you could tell us a little bit about yourself. I'd love to hear about the moments when it all clicked for you, about how your purpose came to be and how your career has sort of taken this direction and what drives you.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for asking that. I'd say really so much of my experience has to do with how I was brought up here in this country. My parents immigrated from India in the 70s, and I was born and raised in Texas, in South Texas, at a time where there weren't really many South Asians in South Texas, and certainly no very, very, very few Sikhs where we grew up. And part of our experience growing up in San Antonio, I have 3 brothers who are also all born and raised there. We were constantly having to ask ourselves why it is that we look different. And the reason we had to ask ourselves that is because people around us would always ask us, I mean, from a really young age. And it wasn't always malicious or nasty. I mean, sometimes it was, but especially when we were kids, it was just curiosity, right? Like people were wondering, why do you wear that on your head? Or what language are you speaking? Or where does your family come from? And these were all just subtle reminders for us that we were different. And of course, there were also difficult and ugly reminders about us being different. And, you know, there was direct racism and personal that hit hard. There was systemic and institutionalized racism that was tough to deal with in a lot of ways. But I'll say the real moment for us, or at least for me, growing up was when 9/11 hit. And this was the moment where, you know, we start getting attacked as a community. We don't really understand what's going on or why people hate us. And of course, you know, racism isn't new, but there's this new experience of feeling like everyone around you recognizes you as their enemy. And as the hate crime started piling up and people we knew were getting attacked and some were getting killed, for me, that was a real inflection point, to recognize that, you know, it's not good enough, to turn the other cheek or to ignore hate when it comes your way. I mean, I think there's some safety in that. It can help diffuse and de-escalate really tense situations. But ultimately, I started to understand in that period, that if I wasn't actively working to deal with the hate that's all around us, then people I knew would be killed and attacked and hated. And I didn't want that for myself, for my community. And so that's what really put me onto the trajectory that I'm on now.
I love that. I feel like you talk about a lot of this in your book that came out. And that's what I really, really wanted to talk about, because I feel like there was so much to unpack there. And one of the things you mentioned in your book was around seek wisdom. So based on your experience that you've had, where did this ideology of seek wisdom come about to be? And what exactly is it?
Yeah, it's a funny thing, because, you know, growing up, and I'm guessing you all experienced this too, like your parents teach you about your heritage and it's annoying. And you're like, why have to spend time on this? And I mean, yeah. I was kind of like that. I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it. I definitely didn't really appreciate it. It was just kind of something my family did. And, you know, that was things like wearing the turban, but also like learning Punjabi and learning Sikh history and other aspects of our lives. And I mean, it was all fine. It was all interesting. It was part of who we were. It wasn't really something we talked about a lot with our friends at school. I mean, it hardly came up. And I think what really happened for me, at least in terms of my appreciation for it, is, you know, you get to college and you start meeting people of different backgrounds. And you're like, what do these people think? And it's different from me. And you have to deal with difference. And it's not just religious, right? There's like racial difference and there's gender difference and sexual orientation. So like, it's this really powerful moment in my life and in many of our lives where our minds start expanding if we allow them to. And for me, part of what I was really interested, especially as I was being racialized as a Muslim and as America's enemy, like I wanted to understand not just what my tradition taught, but I wanted to know, like, who are these Muslim people that I don't know anything about, but people think I'm one of them? Who are Hindus that, like, I don't know anything about Hindus? And so I start studying, and part of my experience of studying religion was starting to recognize that there's actually some relevance. Like it's funny to say now, but like, oh, maybe my parents knew something when they were raising us. Maybe these traditions that have lived on for centuries have something valuable to offer us. And so it was that experience of sort of studying from a distant lens, like, who are these other people, that I started to then ask the questions of, wait, what is my own tradition? And is there something similarly valuable here? And so that's when I really started to delve into it. And what I found, I loved, and I found it to be practical. It made sense to me. Like, some of the questions that I wasn't finding answers to, I was finding answers to through Sikh teachings. And so, yeah, I just kind of fell in love with it in my 20s as I started getting into it, you know, from a almost like a student perspective, like just studying it and learning what I could.
The fate of a futuristic desert kingdom rests in the hands of a princess desperate for power and an assassin with a dark secret in The Phoenix King by Aparna Varma, a novel smoldering with politics, romance, morally gray characters, magic, and technology in an immersive Indian-inspired science fantasy world. This book from Hachette Book Group features jaw-dropping world-building, slow-burn romance, badass female queens, and gorgeous interior art. The Phoenix King was previously self-published as The Boy with Fire in August of 2021, but Orbit's newly revised and edited edition, complete with a new title, has been released, and both the book and author are wildly popular on TikTok. It was also named one of the best new fantasies of 2023 by Pace Magazine, IO9, and Pop Sugar. And it was named an Amazon Best Science Fiction and Fantasy of September / an editor's pick. Check it out now at the links in our episode notes.
One of the things that you just said that struck me is the concept of sort of cultivating compassion towards the people that who might not have compassion for you, but also it sounds like it started from, rather than fear of something that you didn't know, just being like, okay, let me just learn about this. I just want to know exactly what this is. And let me find, explore this a little bit and see what our commonalities are and see where my identity fits into all of this. And I think that that's something really beautiful. How do you suggest that people cultivate compassion towards people who might not have it? Because especially in the last, few years, and especially when it comes to things like race, I think people boil into frustration so quickly that it gets to the point where it's very hard to put yourself in someone else's shoes, to think for a moment about what they might be feeling and to even remotely think outside of yourself in moments of pain.
And like you said, Annika, it's like, we're angry. I'm upset. And I really want to feel those feelings. But also, I also want to be compassionate. I don't know. It's very hard to navigate sometimes because you want to feel the emotions that you're feeling in that moment. But how do you best put it together?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough question and one that I think we all have to find our own answers to. One of the things that I go back to, right? Like let's step back to me being in college and encountering difference. And essentially what I found is, when I do diversity trainings or when I do workshops with college students, people's reactions are typically one of two, right? Like either they shut down and they're like, I'm not dealing with this, right? Like think about people who encounter difference and are like, nope, I'm not thinking about that. I'm not talking about that. I'm not dealing with that. And in many ways, that's such an easy option, right? Like, you don't have to deal with the challenges that you face in life, and what an easy way to live that can be. But we've also seen how painful that can be, and how much harm that causes, not just to others who are affected by people's closed-mindedness, but even those who are closed-minded. How difficult their lives become in dealing with the people that they are going to encounter on a daily basis. So there's that. And then our other approach so often is to push back, right? Like I do these diversity trainings and so often people come in thinking that I'm attacking them. And I'm like, no, this is not about you. Like it is about you, but like nobody's here to judge you or to call you out, but like just step back for a second and be open and curious about what you might be doing that could be harmful to others or closed-minded in ways that you might not even recognize. And so those two approaches that I think are so instinctive to us, right? Fight or flight, essentially, right? Either way, we're shutting down. We're not willing to engage with other people. And now if we think about where we've had these experiences of opening our hearts and opening our minds, and for many of us, like the most profound experience of that is in college. Like those are moments where curiosity leads the way, right? We're not there to feel like this is about us. We're not there to feel like what's being taught to us is an attack or an assault on our identities. We're there to learn, and those opportunities we embrace. And so, the tricky thing about this is that we live in a culture where it's not that easy to be vulnerable sometimes, to admit that you don't know everything already. Right. We're so often pretending like we have all the answers and we're never wrong. But I think, the beginning point with humility and curiosity and vulnerability, like those three things together, I think to me, at least that's the starting point for compassion.
How do you teach curiosity? I mean, I think that a lot of people I feel like when we're younger, we have more curiosity. We're more open to, I feel like we're so new to the world that we're more open to everything. And then as soon as people start hurting you and picking at you and picking on those scabs, I feel like the curiosity kind of dies. You're like, tit for tat, you did this to me. I don't want to be a learn about you. So how do you kind of get rid of that layer of onion?
Yeah. Can I give you something that I've been thinking about recently? So I mean, there are many ways you can teach curiosity and to really cultivate it in ways that, like, I mean, here's a point that's tangential, but relevant. I have two really young girls, and what I see in them is a constant curiosity and a constant expansion of their minds and their hearts, right? Like, they're constantly growing. And what I'm deathly afraid of for them, because I know it's inevitable, is that they'll be socialized out of their curiosity, right? We're taught not to be curious. We are told, don't ask those questions, right? Like, in all kinds of forms. And so part of the challenge for us is to recognize that part of being human is being curious, right? That's who we are. And to recognize that that's sort of sucked out of us from a really young age, and to return to that is something that's really beautiful. Now, the thing that I've been thinking about recently, it's not a new idea for me, and probably not a new idea for many of you, but I think it relates to curiosity in ways that I haven't really thought about. And that is, in a simple phrase that people will recognize, learning to live with paradox. And another way of saying that is accepting multiple truths, being open to multiple truths. And here's where that ties in with curiosity, right? So often our curiosity is shut down because we are satisfied with a single answer, right? We're taught with the scientific method, there's one answer to every question, you figure out that answer and you're done. But we know as humans, like, my truth and my lived experience is different from yours and different from everyone else's. And we can each have our own experiences of the truth. We each have our own perspectives. And that's not something we're really taught, right? We're so focused on the single answer. That's what we learn in school, right? What's 5 + 5? What's the formula for sodium chloride, right? Like, whatever it is, there's always one thinking that can really spark our curiosity and to help people open up to the possibility that there are other ways of living in this world and other ways of experiencing what we all experience, right? I think that, to me, is a real starting point for curiosity that, at least for me, is something that I'm thinking about a lot these days.
That's a really good point. I think that, you know, my dad and I were talking, it's funny when you were mentioning your girls, about how when kids are really small and you hand them like a bottle or a sippy cup and they're sitting at their high chair, the first thing they do is just like turn it upside down because they just want to watch everything come out and spill.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, so my annoying. God, my rug, my carpet, my floor, you know, and you're freaking out. And my dad kept making fun of me. He's like, you did this all the time when you were little and I just could not figure you out. And I was telling him how nowadays they have these cups and these bowls or whatever that have like suction on top and they don't let things like come out. They can only like reach your hand in and get your food. And my brother looked at me while I was having this conversation and he said, I feel like that completely kills the kid's curiosity about what's going to happen if you overflow the cup or you jump it out or you like do something that seems completely dumb to the adult, but like so brilliant to this child. And it's a lot of sort of what you say. I think that if we apply that to these adult concepts, we are often told that, you know, there's a right and a wrong and there's, you know, an X solution and a Y that is absolutely not the way to go. And, you know, if we don't do those prescribed methods, that you're obviously just being led down some sort of terrible path that's never going to lead to anything good, as opposed to saying, within your rights and within, you know, ethics, just think about what all the possibilities are and think through what these mean. And perhaps you'll find more gray area that you can kind of play with and the whole world gets bigger because you're looking at that. And I, you know, I'm struck by that because I think we don't think about curiosity in adults ever anymore. And especially now, and especially in, you know, I would say the last 10 years with social media, with all these things, we're being fed these ideas all the time that kind of limit how much exploration we can do with our belief systems and our approaches to other people.
I don't think I'm curious at all anymore. I feel like I'm like, oh, give me the answer. Google, TikTok, something. Just tell me what it is. Like, I'll figure it. Like, the answer is right there. I feel like I've lost my curiosity, which sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, part of what else, I mean, I feel the same pain around losing curiosity and something I'm actively trying to bring back, but tied to curiosity is creativity, right? And tied to curiosity is compassion. Yeah. And so, you know, people might be thinking, well, what's the big deal? Like, maybe we don't need to know as much as we used to? And I'll say, sure, like we do have information that's accessible to us, but what else do we lose? And there's some of the things that are most treasured, right, within our humanity, right? Being creative, being compassionate, feeling a sense of wonder within this world. So you're living in awe. I think curiosity also sparks gratitude, right? Because you're constantly like thinking and engaging with the world around you. So anyway, there's so much that comes out of curiosity, or at least that's tied to it, that I think we do lose if we're not able to regain it from our younger years.
Aside from curiosity, creativity, and compassion, what are some other aspects of Sikh wisdom that can be applied to our day-to-day that, you know, you've studied or you've seen or you've written about in your book that you could share with us?
Oh, there's so much. I mean, there's so many aspects of Sikh philosophy that I think are useful for today's world. I mean, I'll give one that I think is something that a lot of us are struggling with right now, and that is how do you actually get to a point where you can deal with all the darkness and still have hope and still have optimism? And I'll share a really simple story that that speaks to this. It's from my childhood, and it's where I really learned this practice. But it was right after 9/11. We were on lockdown at our house. We're getting death threats and, you know, drive-bys and all that kind of stuff. And after about a day, my dad is like, we're so lucky. And I was like, what are you talking about? There's like, our country's under attack, our people are being attacked. And like, I don't think you understand what's happening. And he's like, well, did you notice that all your neighbors are coming by with food, and all your teammates and your coaches and your teachers they're all checking in on you to make sure you're okay? Like, aren't we lucky to have such good friends? And I mean, he didn't say it this explicitly then, but I think what he was pointing out was, if you choose to look for it, there is so much more goodness in the world than there is bad. And that's a teaching from Sikh philosophy, right? Like the light is constantly all around us, and it's up to us if we want to see it. And it's something that's really saved me. I mean, especially these last 6-7 years that have felt really dark and constant, that anytime I lose hope, or feel like, people suck, which is often, right? Like it's hard not to feel like that sometimes. I just go out and I go observe the world around me, and I notice the things that I take for granted a lot of the times, right? Like the goodness in people and what they're willing to do for one another, even when they're strangers. And that practice actually gives me a lot of hope and optimism for our future, especially right now where it's hard to find that sometimes.
That's really powerful. I think I keep envisioning, you know, during that time, because I was in ninth grade and during 9/11, and, you know, I'm from a small white college town, and I can't remember specific effects like that, but I do remember, because we don't really have a Sikh population where I grew up, but I do remember reading about it, and I can't imagine the fear that must have been felt. And then for those moments, for your dad to still find the light when you're fearful for your family and you're fearful for your loved ones, and you're sitting there and you're afraid of what's happening to this country that you now call home, and, you know, all of these different elements, it must have been, when you're a kid, I think, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you're kind of like, what are you talking about? You know, but when you're older, you find how rooting that kind of perspective is, and how magical it kind of is. It transforms everything around you if you're willing to look for that. I think the other thing that you had said earlier was how you, and this was something I related to very hard too, was just how when you're little and you hear about your traditions, it's sort of like in one ear and kind of half out the other one. Like you're like really not paying attention. But then as you get older, you find that you marvel at the same things that you perhaps rolled your eyes at when you were younger.
Exactly.
You know, I, you talk in your book about tradition and what it's like when you put your turban on. And I would love to hear more about that in terms of, like, you know, what do you feel when you're doing that, and what ties do you have to Sikh religion that you hope your children will carry with you, you know, with them, and how the ties that you feel now as an adult, essentially, that perhaps you rolled your eyes at as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, some things change and some things don't. And in some ways, I'm the same person I was, what, 30 years ago as an 8-year-old. And in some ways, it feels like I'm a totally different person. And that's kind of the funny thing about life sometimes.
Yeah.
With the turban, it's part of what I love about it is, and I think anyone who belongs to a community of some sort might be able to relate to this. There's something really cool about tying the turban or reciting the daily prayers, that as I'm doing those actions, I am feeling connected to people all around the world who I've never met, and knowing that this is something that they do too. I mean, part of the experience after 9/11 being racialized, right? Like, I didn't really know many Sikhs growing up, but all of a sudden I started relating to Sikhs and Muslims and South Asians, being like, oh, I don't know these people, but I know what their lives are like right now. And nobody else really knows what it's like. And there's like a real bond that you form around that. And so there's this like really cool experience of connection with people you don't know, but you know that you have shared values or you have shared practices, and there's something that ties you together, like an invisible string. And that's true over history too, right? Like, there's something really powerful about the possibility of looking back and knowing that you are connected to people. You know, your ancestors, my grandparents said the same things when they were kids, or they had the same practices. My ancestors, my, you know, other people of my tradition that aren't related to me. It's like, that's a really cool experience. I mean, and it doesn't have to be religion again, right? Like, it can be through sports. It could be through, you know, nationality. Like, there are all sorts of forms of group identity that allow for this. But I really love that about the turban, and particularly what I think about as I'm tying the turban. And this is a practice I learned when I was probably a teenager, was to think about the values it represents for me. And it's just a really brief moment. Like, it doesn't take me that long to tie a turban, but it gives me 30 seconds, 60 seconds of reflection of what am I committing to when I wear this, and what am I going to stand for? And part of the irony is, for many people, what they see when they see the turban is the exact opposite of what it means to me, right? Like, to me, it means service, justice, compassion. And for a lot of people, they see it and they're like, terrorism, hatred, misogyny. I'm like, oh man, we got a disconnect here. But even that has been a really powerful experience for me to learn not to rely on other people's assumptions to validate who I am as a person, and really to be clear about what it means to me. Because the moment that I lose that, like, there's no point in wearing one anymore, right? Like, it's gone for me. So it's something that I hold on to really, really dearly.
Bad baby alert. Masala Podcast is a multi-award-winning South Asian feminist podcast all about taboo topics in South Asian culture. Everything from sex, sexuality, periods, porn, menopause, mental health, and more. After 4 successful seasons in the UK, the next podcast season comes to the US, featuring Hollywood actors, magazine editors, and massive music icons. Listen to Masala Podcast on all podcasting platforms today.
What parts do you think that you hope that your daughters are going to carry forward? Because their experience is going to be very similar, hopefully, in terms of finding the beauty, finding the connection, knowing that their parents and their grandparents and all of them had all of the same traditions, but, you know, it's going to look a little bit different, and even more different because, you know, like us, they grew up in the US. And so, you know, it's going to be a little bit different for them too. Just their sheer experience of being South Asian here is going to be very different than what their grandparents looked like. So what is it that you hope goes with them, carry that they carry most?
It's a great question. I mean, I think for me, as I think about it with my kids, I'm like, all any parent wants is for their kids to be happy, right? Like, at the end of the day,
yeah,
that's all that matters. And so for me, it's there's a push and pull here, which is, I have found immense happiness through Sikh wisdom. So I want them to have that available to them if they want it. And so that means raising them within the tradition, giving them the tools to access it, connecting them with community who is there. And also I want to be, this is easier said than done, but I want to be honest about my belief that you don't have to be a Sikh to find happiness, and you don't have to be sick to be a good person, and you don't have to be a Sikh to find enlightenment. And like, as much as I would love personally for them to find love in something that I love, and also for us to be able to share it, right? Like kind of like how I want her to be a Spurs fan, because I want both of them to be Spurs fans so that we could share it and share that love together. Like more than that, I'm like, okay, if this isn't the path for you, I want to be able to be okay with that. And that's like, I'm guessing that, I don't know, it would be very difficult for me if she didn't end up as a Spurs fan. I think I would be okay with it if she chose another path in terms of her spiritual and religious practice. But really for me at the end of it, it's about finding happiness. And I think Sikh philosophy has a lot to offer there. So I hope she's able to tap into it to some degree, at least.
Oh, I love that. I hope she listens to this, or they both listen to this someday. Yeah. And be like, Dad, I love Spurs. I love the Spurs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh my God. Or they say the opposite and break my heart.
Well, I hope that it's like, you know, I would laugh if it came out to be like, all right, Dad, you know, I absolutely love Sikhism, but I mean, the Spurs are okay. I feel like that might actually break your heart a little more. Oh, but, you know.
It happened to my brother recently, and it was so sad for him.
No.
He was like, I'm such a failure.
Honestly, I have my sports loyalties as well. None of them are in Texas, so I can't say anything to you right now, but I get that feeling on a cellular level. But as you were talking through the one thing I know with Sikhism, this is going to be kind of a funny, weird parallel, but so we were watching Indian matchmaking because that's just what we do. Right. Yeah. And they're one of the stars of the show on this season is obviously Sikh. He's probably my favorite storyline because he seems like such a good human being.
I love and him.
The one thing I noticed multiple times is that he kept bringing up his turban with apprehension. Mm. And I was kind of thinking like, why is he doing that at first? And then I was thinking about it a lot actually afterward, and I realized how many misconceptions must have come from our own community, because he's not meeting people outside of our community on that show.
Right.
But how many misconceptions must have come from our own people for him to feel the need to bring it up, and how that must have felt on a daily basis to have to kind of carry that as a concern, as something that's so close and so meaningful to you, but then also to think, well, you know, even my own people might have some sort of questions about this, or like, I might have to explain myself with this. And I know that that means that within our own diaspora, there's going to be key issues that people don't know about, or that people haven't thought through, and that maybe they should. So I was wondering if you had any kinds of key issues that we should be drawing our attention to when it comes to Sikhism or social justice or offering effective allyship, particularly through the cases of violence that you've talked about, which we've all seen, and that have been increased amounts of, especially in New York, and things like that. Are there issues that we should be paying special attention to?
Yeah, you know, I love this question, and I love this conversation too, because, you know, so often we'll talk with fellow Desis about our experiences, but it ends up at a superficial level, and we're kind of like, okay, cool, we got you. But it never gets to a point where we actually get to know one another in a deeper way. And I mean, like part of the challenge is South Asia is a big place, and there are lots of people, and mm-hmm. there's so much diversity there. And, you know, how do you wrap your arms around all the different kinds of lived experiences? I mean, that's hard. But I think, you know, going back to our point around curiosity, one thing that I would love for us to be better at is to just be open to learning about one another's experiences, right? And so here's the challenge that the Sikhs face within the Desi context, is, I mean, especially within the diaspora, but even back in South Asia, we are a relatively visible community in South Asia in a way that we're not in the States, right? In the States, it's a tiny fraction of the population. In India, it's still a fraction of the population, but much more visible, much more known, right? Like most people are there aren't confused about who Sikhs are. But there, as here, if you ask people three questions, like digging in, right? Like, tell me three things about Sikhism or Sikh tea. I mean, no one knows anything. And that's such a strange way for us to live alongside one another, where most of us know about whatever the majority community is, right? Like by default, I grew up in the States learning about Christianity. People in India know about Hindu teachings and traditions. And, you know, that's very normative. And then we'll learn about others. And then wherever I go, whether it's here or there or anywhere, I'll say, well, what do you know about Sikhism? And people are like, I got nothing. And to your point earlier, and I loved your opening, your honesty around, you know, this point about Sikhism being presented as an offshoot of Hinduism. I mean, that's a standard narrative, in textbooks, in scholarship. I mean, it's been debunked now pretty well, and addressed at least among scholars, but that hasn't filtered down to the textbook. So it's not just that we're not known, it's that we're misunderstood or misperceived. And that's, you know, we can point our fingers at white supremacists and be like, hey, you think you're getting a Muslim, but really that's, you don't know who that is. But then we look at ourselves and we're like, oh wait, do we even know who we're talking about here? Right? Like it's the same problem. And so part of, for me, what I'm really focused on in my work with the Aspen Institute, is to really build what we call religious pluralism, right? A society where everyone can thrive no matter what they believe, or if they don't believe anything, or how they look, or where they come from. Like to get there, one of the key starting points is just learning about one another. And that's not something that we do well in this country. It's not something we really put much attention towards in the diaspora generally. And so for me, like one really important step that everyone can take is just like, hey, let me learn about these few cultures, regions, languages, peoples that I don't know much about. And just that simple act of learning creates a bridge for connecting and supporting in ways that we don't feel invested in otherwise. So that's my recommendation on a good starting point.
I definitely think though social media has changed that, because maybe I am a curious person after all, but I recently started following this account called Sikh Expo. And I've learned so much about the culture because of that. The shooting that I had mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, I had read about the 10th year of what had happened just recently. And that's where I got my knowledge from. I also learned recently, or yesterday, when a lot of people were celebrating India's Independence Day, a lot of people in the Sikh community were actually talking about the partition and, you know, all the loss that was faced. And so what I had said earlier, maybe social media kills curiosity. I think in a way it's also sparked curiosity, because I have so much resources in my hand of like different communities and quick and easy bite-sized pieces of content that I'm constantly learning about so many different cultures at once.
Totally. Totally. And I would say the difference is like what you just described. You just have to be intentional about it, right? Yeah. Like there's information everywhere. Social media is full of really good info. Yeah. Instagram, TikTok, wherever you go, there's good stuff. You just have to care.
Exactly. Like, you have to care. That's the biggest thing. I mean, if people could just post about it, you can easily swipe away, but it's that curiosity you keep talking about. Now I can't stop saying the word curiosity. It's like curiosity that's like, oh, maybe let me click into it. Let me visit the profile. Let me read a little bit about it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's huge. It's huge. And it's like, yeah, it's so funny to say this out loud, but it's like, if people just cared, like that's all you really need. Like, just why don't
people just care?
I mean, I think that you're right. There's like some level of, like, you were just, you know, we were talking, like I was saying in the beginning of the intro, like you were just saying here, if we have to come down and say, like, do you know three things about other religions, even within your own sort of like Indian community, for lack of a, you know, just to kind of paint us a little bit more monolithic than we actually are. And just to say, you know, Indian community, if you say like, can you name three things about other religions? I don't know that most people can. And that's like, it's so sad to me. And even as we were going to do this episode and going in, I just kept thinking, you are a bonehead and you need to go do some reading because you haven't done as much as you should. Or it's like you said, a very superficial thing. People will immediately know that Gurdwaras are one of the most service-based places you can ever find. Everyone knows that. That's a commonly known thing. But then when it comes down to advocacy or, you know, really supporting people during times of crisis, like let's say there's an act of violence or an act of, you know, like defacing the front of a building or something like that, who's really stepping up in those moments? You might say, you know, like, oh, Sikhs are known for their service, or Sikhs are known for, you know, their nobility and their pride, or, you know, whatever. Punjabi people are known for partying. South Indians are known for being smart. You want to throw all these stereotypes out, but where are you in the moments that really count? And are you actively doing something to propel those relationships forward? And like Nehal keeps saying, are you curious about how to do that and who to talk to and where to explore to make sure that those relationships go forward? And yeah, I just don't know if people do that often enough. I don't think that they do. And, you know, I mean, hopefully it'll start. Hopefully this episode starts something, at least amongst our listeners. But you know, it is something to think about, and it is like a place to start. You know, it's just like you said, being curious and asking those questions and seeing where you can bring meaning to these relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think part of what we do to ourselves is we say, well, in order to do anything, I have to know everything. And I'm not saying like you don't have to be a scholar on everyone or on every religion or on every community in order to show up for them. But it's hard to show up for people who you don't know, right? Like that's what the science tells us. Like you are much less likely to have bias against someone or have bigoted feelings about someone if you know people in that community personally, if you have some sort of understanding about them. And so what I'm really advocating for is like just take that initial step of creating an opening for a connection. And then you go from there, right? Like you, again, like knowledge is abundant, and knowledge actually, mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't fix our problems, right? We are smart people. We have tons of knowledge available to us. Our world is a disaster. And so we know that knowledge is not the solution, but it is, it does create an opportunity for engaging with one another and connecting with one another. And that's what I'm really hoping for here.
You've done a lot of work for the community and you've become a key social activist, and social activism isn't always easy. It's pretty dark sometimes. And, you know, while we hope that what we do with our podcast ends up falling into that category, who really knows? Hopefully it'll all foster some good change. But I did want to ask you from your perspective, especially because I think in our extensive hour-long conversation, it seems like you approach the world with a lot of gentleness. And I think that I'd love to hear the difference between actual activism versus performative activism from you, given that you treat people with kindness and with gentleness. And sometimes when people talk about those things, they're very harsh, and people have a very hard time thinking of themselves as activists because they're like, oh, I'm just doing it wrong. As opposed to, you know, going in with that mindset of like creating a bridge, taking that first step to build the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things I'll say is our Sikh philosophy teaches us that we're all activists. And I think part of the way that I approach it is, you know, there's this whole conversation around if you have privilege, you have responsibility. And I believe that, right? Like I find that to be important, right? If you have blessings or gifts or whatever it is that you've been given, then you can share that with the world. And that's a great thing. And I think there's something really powerful there. And I think part of what's missing in this part of the conversation, though, is that we don't think so much about how we personally benefit and find more happiness by giving to the world. And so what Sikh philosophy teaches us, and this is really important for me in terms of how I approach this work and also what enables, what really enables loving service as opposed to angry service. And I think like it's so natural to be angry in our mm-hmm. activism because there's so much to be angry about, and that's totally fair. But the difference for me is really recognizing that at the core, what we're trying to do is reduce suffering for ourselves and for the people around us. And activism ultimately is not actually about ourselves, right? In Sikh philosophy and Sikh teachings, to serve other people is to help reduce your ego, which we and many spiritual traditions offer as being the root of human suffering. So service helps you find happiness by decentering your ego, and it also reduces other people's suffering because you're addressing whatever concerns that they have, whether it be poverty or health or whatever they're facing. And so to me, that it's that outlook that your activism is ultimately not about yourself. It's purely about serving other people. And really, when it's at its best, you're actively erasing your sense of self, right? I think that's really different from what we do today, right? Today, we're so focused mm-hmm. on scoring the social points by saying the right things and saying them as loudly as we can and calling people out. And like, so much of what I see, especially among my students as I talk to them, is like activism is like a game now, and people see it as winning and losing. And I think that's such a tough way to live, right? Where mm-hmm. you're constantly like, I want to be ahead of you, and I want to make sure you're behind me. And like, it just reproduces the same kinds of hierarchies that we have. So for me, the outlook of service as being something that's not about me, and there's no zero sum game, and there's no winners or losers, right? Like, the whole point is to make sure that everybody's winning. That to me is a really different way of engaging that I've really found happiness through.
That means a lot. I think that just thinking about the concept of, you know, selfless awareness and selfless compassion rather than selfish outrage is a very different kind of approach to everything that we're used to. And like you said, it's not a race. And that's something really important to keep in mind in an era that is sadly fueled by a lot of anger and sadly fueled by a lot of hate and a lot of those call outs. So I really appreciate you sharing that. I think it resonates very, very loudly, actually.
You just said it's not a race, and that's what my, so I've, these two young girls, and they're constantly running everywhere. Anytime we're outside, they're running. And sometimes they'll like turn it into a competition, and then whoever's losing eventually will be like, it's not a race.
I always used to say that. That was me as a child. Yeah.
But the beautiful thing about it is like, once they agree that it's not a race, like sometimes they won't agree, but when they agree, then what usually ends up happening, and I know this is like, this is going to feel like super cliche, but like they end up like holding hands and going together. And like, it's such a different way of journeying, right? Like then they're not competing it. Like it's just that, I guess the point is then they're both enjoying the process, right? They're both enjoying the journey together instead of being so focused on the outcome and who's where. So anyway, there's some kind of lesson in there, even though it's kind of a funny connection.
From very young children are just, I feel like, the center of this episode and many things we're learning. I feel like we should just start a series of, like, the things we learn from kids. We learn from kids should just be the series now.
I don't know about you, but I feel warm and fuzzy leaving this conversation. I feel like you've given us a lot to think about, and I hope our listeners can learn a little something or two and get your book, because I feel like there's so many good insights in there. But listeners, you can follow Simran at SikhProf on Instagram, and follow us at That They See Spark on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, keep lighting That They See Spark.